The sun was sinking behind the mountains, and the shadows were deepening in the woods when they went on again. Their paths now went into thickets where the dusk had already gathered. Night came beneath the trees as they walked, and the elves uncovered their silver lamps. Suddenly they came out into the open again and found themselves under a pale evening sky pricked with a few early stars. There was a wide, treeless space before them, running in a great circle and bending away on either hand. Beyond it was a deep fosse, left in soft shadow, but the grass upon its brink was green, as if it glowed still in memory of the sun that had shone. Upon the further side there rose to a great height a green wall, encircling a green hill, thronged with mallorn trees, taller than any that they had yet seen in all the land. Their height could not be guessed, but they stood up in the twilight like living towers. In their many-tiered branches, and amid their ever-moving leaves, countless lights were gleaming, green and gold and silver. Haldir turned towards the company. "Welcome to Kharas Galadon," he said. "Here is the city of the Galadrim, where dwell the Lord Celeborn and Galadriel, the Lady of Lothlorien."
Back again.
Mm-hmm. We've got Chapter 7, The Mirror of Galadriel.
Yeah, all right. We're going pretty well through this book right now.
I know. It's one of those moments where I hadn't been paying close attention, and then all of a sudden I was like, wait, there's so little left.
I know.
In the book after this.
Well, like, the weird part is, it's like, yeah, once we get through the Lothlorien chapters, then it's like, well, we're pretty close to Two Towers.
And right.
Since we're still in quarantine, we could probably just not take a break and just keep going into it. So we'll see. But yeah, anyways, we got to talk about this chapter here. They meet Celeborn and Galadriel. That's the big event. So we got to talk about their greeting, meeting, everything. Then we'll discuss a little bit about what life's like there. And then obviously we got to hit a whole conversation at the end with looking into the Mirror of Galadriel, where this chapter gets its title. All right. Mm-hmm. But before all that, Cliff's notes.
So the company comes to Kharas Galadon, which is the capital of Lothlorien. They ascend into the trees and meet Galadriel and Celeborn, the Lord and Lady of the Forest. They break the news of Gandalf's demise, which comes as a shock even to the otherwise all-knowing elves. Galadriel offers her cryptic wisdom and stares into the hearts of each of the company, one at a time. That night they sleep soundly, completely protected and relieved. After a few days, Frodo begins to feel like it is time to leave. While walking through the woods with Sam, Galadriel appears and invites Frodo and Sam to stare into her mirror, which reveals dark visions.
Okay, cool. So, Cliff's Notes done. Yeah, okay, so they enter the city. No folk could they see, nor hear any feet upon the paths, but there were many voices about them, and in the air above. Far away on the hill, they could hear the sound of singing falling from on high like soft rain upon leaves. They start climbing some stairs, and they're going to the biggest tree in the entire place. And then Haldir tells them that the Lord Celeborn and Lady Galadriel dwell in this tree, so they climb up it. At the top of the main trunk, where it then starts to split off into a bunch of different big branches, I guess, there's a big talon, which is like those flat platforms.
Platform, yeah.
And this one, like, is like the size of like a boat deck is what it says. And there's a house in the middle of it. And this is a decent sized house. And then, yeah, so now we get to them.
The chamber was filled with a soft light, and its walls were green and silver, and its roof was of gold. Many elves were seated there. On two chairs beneath the bole of the tree, and canopied by a living bow, there sat, side by side, Celeborn and Galadriel. They stood up to greet their guests, after the manner of elves, even those who were accounted mighty kings. Very tall they were, and the lady no less than the lord, and they were grave and beautiful. They were clad wholly in white, and the hair of the lady was of deep gold, and the hair of the Lord Kelborn was of silver, long and bright. But no sign of age was upon them, unless it were in the depths of their eyes, for these were keen as lances in the starlight, and yet profound, the wells of deep memory.
Yeah, so then they greet everybody. Frodo gets a greeting, is what it looks like, because he's the most important. Aragorn gets a greeting, Legolas gets a greeting, and then even Gimli gets one too, because it's weird that there's a dwarf there. You have any thoughts on those? I thought Aragorn's was the most interesting.
Remind me.
So in Aragorn's, they said he hasn't been here for 38 years, and then to quote, "And those years lie heavy on you, but the end is near, for good or ill. Here lay aside your burden for a while."
Yeah. These two, Celeborn and Galadriel, are heavy on the sort of foreshadowing or speaking like they might be able to see the future.
Mm-hmm.
That's, yeah, it's always very cryptic.
Well, let's get into some of their actual dialogue here then. Mm-hmm, just to highlight this even more. "When all the guests were seated before his chair, the Lord looked at them again. 'Here there are eight,' he said. 9 were set out. So said the messages. But maybe there has been some change of counsel that we have not heard. Elrond is far away, and darkness gathers between us. And all this year the shadows have grown longer."
"Nay, there was no change of counsel," said the Lady Galadriel, speaking for the first time. Her voice was clear and musical, but deeper than a woman's wont. "Gandalf the Grey set out with his company, but he did not pass the borders of this land. Now tell us where he is, for I much desire to speak with him again, but I cannot see him from afar unless he comes within the fences of Lothlorien. A grey mist is about him, and the ways of his feet and of his mind are hidden from me." "Alas," said Aragorn, "Gandalf the Grey fell into shadow. He remained in Moria and did not escape."
At these words, all the elves in the hall cried out aloud in grief and amazement. "These are evil tidings," said Celeborn, "the most evil that have been spoken here in long years full of grievous deeds." He turned to Haldir. "Why has nothing of this been told to me before?" he asked in the elven tongue.
"We have not spoken to Haldir of our deeds or our purpose," said Legolas. "At first we were weary, and danger was too close behind, and afterwards we almost forgot our grief for a time, as we walked in gladness on the fair paths of Lorien." "Yet our grief is great, and our loss cannot be mended," said Frodo. "Gandalf was our guide, and he led us through Moria, and when our escape seemed beyond hope, he saved us, and he fell."
Then from there, Aragorn recounts the whole Carathas deal trying to climb over the mountain, and then everything in the mines, and they mention the Balrog, how it was an ancient evil of the world, both a shadow and a flame. And Celeborn says, "Alas," said Celeborn, "we have long feared that under Carathas a terror slept. But had I known that the dwarves had stirred up this evil in Moria again, I would have forbid you to pass the northern borders, you and all that went with you. And if it were possible, one would say that at the last Gandalf fell from wisdom into folly, going needlessly into the net of Moria."
"He would be rash indeed that said that thing," said Galadriel gravely. "Needless were none of the deeds of Gandalf in life. Those that followed him knew not his mind and cannot report his full purpose. But however it may be with the guide, the followers are blameless. Do not repent of your welcome to the dwarf. If our folk had been exiled long and far from Lothlorien, who of the Galadrim, even Celeborn the Wise, would pass night and would not wish to look upon their ancient home, though it had become an abode of dragons? Dark is the water of Kel-Azaram, and cold are the springs of Kibble-Nala, and fair were the many-pillared halls of Khazad-dûm in elder days, before the fall of mighty kings beneath the stone." She looked upon Gimli, who sat glowering and sad, and she smiled. And the dwarf, hearing the names given in his own ancient tongue, looked up and met her eyes, and it seemed to him that he looked suddenly into the heart of an enemy and saw there love and understanding. Wonder came into his face, and then he smiled in answer.
He rose clumsily and bowed in dwarf fashion, saying, "Yet more fair is the living land of Lorien, and the Lady Galadriel is above all the jewels that lie beneath the earth." All right, so that was a big chunk. Brings up lots of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, I think that, well, first off, both raises and puts to bed the tension between the elves and the dwarves, which we had mentioned previously. You know, they blindfolded everyone coming into Lorien because of Gimli.
Right.
And now Celeborn gave his welcome to Gimli and then right away rescinds it. Shame on you, dwarf. Like,
yeah.
Why'd you let... It's basically your fault that Gandalf died.
And what does his wife do?
Well, she basically... I won't say, like, cuts him off, but she corrects him. She provides the kind of measured voice of wisdom here.
Yeah, like twice. Twice.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very explicit. Her language is old-fashioned in the way that Tolkien writes some of these characters. So it sounds archaic, but she's basically saying, as soon as he says this, she's like, yeah, you would be crazy if you said that.
Well, so the first thing that he said was, or the first, one of the two things that she was like correcting him on was, Celeborn was even saying like, hey, you know, Gandalf's last act of going into Moria, that was dumb. That was like really a detriment. And she said, she basically says like, no. Gandalf's one of those kind of people that like, anything he does is for a useful purpose, even if we can't understand it. But you're kind of a fool. She doesn't quite say it, but you're a fool to say he was, you know, he did something stupid. Like, everything he did was always measured and probably correct. And then she's defending Gimli and the dwarves, saying, like, you know, almost, like, basically empathizing with them. What if Lothlorien was taken over by evil and you pass by it and you would feel the same way Gimli does here, right?
Which is, I mean, it's funny because it's not really that hard for her to make that case. Celeborn would be being super unreasonable if he's like, because of this thing that maybe it's kind of the dwarves were involved in waking up this evil in the mountain a very long time ago, you dwarf are therefore responsible for the bad things that this thing has done.
Right. Yeah. So Celeborn's kind of like, he's showing like, yeah, the elves, they're really cool in this book and everything, but they're not 100% perfect, you know.
Yes.
I mean, because seriously, like, think about how Gimli probably feels right now. Like, you know, he's had a few rude greetings from elves throughout the book so far. Legolas hasn't been particularly friendly to him at all. The elves they meet in Lothlorien clearly dislike dwarves just straight off the bat, and they try to call him out alone to be blindfolded, and it's thanks to Aragorn that they're going to have everybody do it, I guess. And then the worst is, like we were just saying, like, Celeborn and all these elves, they just assume it's everything that's evil in Moria is the dwarves' fault for letting it happen. So out of everybody, Gimli probably feels the most isolated and out of place in Lothlorien here.
Right.
Until, unexpectedly, you know, it's Galadriel that shows him, like, that. There's the line you read there. She shows him love and understanding, which is a pretty big deal. You know, so we're starting to, I guess we're starting to meet Galadriel, and even though she's weird and cryptic, this was a pretty compassionate moment, I think, because she reaches out to the not quite enemy, natural enemy, but odd companion, maybe.
Yes, the stranger, maybe.
Right, like the strangest companion, probably.
It also, this interaction lends an air, like, Celeborn feels like the lord of this fiefdom, this kingdom, as we would expect. Its borders are super well defended, and it's like this island in a storm up against evil, and so we would expect him to be, like, very nitpicky about who gets to come in,
right,
and snippy and aggressive, and she seems like she's in a different category, you know? Like, she's not really concerned with this kingdom specifically, but with a much broader view of history.
In the lead up to this chapter, we actually did a whole special on Galadriel's whole history, basically only within the context of Middle-earth. So not like sources that would have influenced Tolkien, just like who the hell Galadriel is and like how she got here.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously Celeborn's heavily attached to that. And so in that, what we basically established is Galadriel's really, really old, and she's one of the Noldor who lived in Valinor, and she's been surrounded by like wise mentors and everything, and she's very wise and powerful herself. Versus her husband, who is a Sindar elf, so he would have dwelt with Thingol. And so, like, if you even think back to Thingol, it's like that guy was also one that had heavily protected borders, you know, didn't like outsiders at all. So it's kind of like just the natural default concept probably for these kinds of elves. And they really just when it comes straight down to it, they're not as wise as the Noldor. And so, I don't know. So that's kind of, that might be going on here with why Galadriel, and we try to highlight it in the special a little bit, like Galadriel definitely has a bigger world outlook than Celeborn does, even as they're setting up Lothlorien, which we'll go over in that special. Yeah, but anyways, Gimli, big connection here, basically probably just destroyed his whole concept of elves in one fell swoop right here, is what she did.
Yeah,
but we'll see how that plays out. Okay. Galadriel apologizes and he says he'll aid the Fellowship however possible.
Celeborn apologizes.
What did I say?
Galadriel.
Oh, okay. Celeborn apologizes and says he'll aid them however possible. And then bottom of page 347. You want to read Galadriel?
Your quest is known to us, said Galadriel, looking at Frodo, but we will not here speak of it more openly. Yet not in vain will it prove, maybe, that you came to this land seeking aid, as Gandalf himself plainly purposed. For the Lord of the Galadrim is accounted the wisest of the elves of Middle-earth, and the giver of gifts beyond the power of kings. He has dwelt in the west since the days of dawn, and I have dwelt with him years uncounted, for ere the fall of Nargothrond or Gondolin, I passed over the mountains, and together through the ages of the world we have fought the long defeat. It was I who first summoned the White Council, and if my designs had not gone amiss, it would have been governed by Gandalf the Grey, and then mayhap things would have gone otherwise. But even now there is hope left. I will not give you counsel, saying do this or do that, for not in doing or contriving, nor in choosing between this course and another, I can avail, but only in knowing what was and is, and in part also what shall be. But this I will say to you, your quest stands upon the edge of a knife. Stray but a little, and it will fail, to the ruin of all. Yet hope remains while all the company is true.
And with that word she held them in her eyes, and in silence looked searchingly at each of them in turn. None save Legolas and Aragorn could long endure her glance. Sam quickly blushed and hung his head. At length the Lady Galadriel released them from her eyes, and she smiled.
Do not let your hearts be troubled, she said. Tonight you shall sleep in peace. Then they sighed and felt suddenly weary, as those who have been questioned long and deeply, though no words had been spoken openly.
Go now, said Celeborn. You are worn with sorrow and much toil. Even if your quest did not concern us closely, you should have refuge in this city, until you were healed and refreshed. Now you shall rest, and we will not speak of your further road for a while. Okay, so that was really big too. Lots to talk about. We got to kind of do this in a disjointed way. So first of all, kind of interesting, she said she passed over the mountains before the fall of Nargothrond and Gondolin.
Yeah, that's way back in...
Yeah.
Well into Cimmerillion times.
Yeah, and that's also kind of... Well, you know, Lord of the Rings was the published thing, so this should be canonical, but I don't really know how well that matches up with Galadriel's history that we covered. So, tune in. Because I'm not quite sure that lines up. Mm-hmm. Even though that sounds like a good idea to me. Anyways, that's... besides the point. Okay, together we've fought the long defeat. That's a big quote. We're going to address that at the end of this section. She was the first one to summon the White Council and wanted Gandalf to be the head. That was kind of interesting.
Yeah. She just brushed over that, but the White Council, that's the wizards, right?
It's not just quite the wizards. It's like wizards and then the most powerful elves. We actually...
So that was Gandalf and Saruman and
Elrond would be in there.
Elrond, Galadriel, we presume.
Maybe Glorfindel, I don't know. Glorfindel probably gets to show up with Elrond.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, the other wizards too, like Radagast or somebody. We actually, there was
And Saruman is the head of the White Council, right?
Yeah, he's the head, because he's the head of the wizards. So,
mm-hmm.
But yeah, she wanted Gandalf to be the head. That was kind of interesting. And she called it to be. Quest stands upon the edge of a knife, stray but a little, and will fail to the ruin of all. Yet hope remains if the company is true. That... that's a winning speech. Like, that's not a downer in any way.
No.
Okay. So she stares them all down, and 6 out of 8 can't endure it. Sam blushes.
Although the language is actually can't long endure it.
Okay.
Or only Legolas and Aragorn could long endure it, which suggests that maybe all of them broke at some point.
Possibly. Yeah. So Sam blushes. He later says, if you want to know, I felt as if I hadn't got nothing on, and I didn't like it. She seemed to be looking inside me and asking me what I would do if she gave me the chance of flying back home to the Shire to a nice little hole with a bit of garden of my own. And goes on to say, too, all of them, it seemed, had fared alike. Each had felt that he was offered a choice between a shadow full of fear that lay ahead and something that he greatly desired. Clear before his mind it lay, and to get it, he only had to turn aside from the road and leave the quest and the war against Sauron to others. Pretty interesting.
Yeah, so it's like she's really drilling into every person's consciousness and saying, are you going to stray?
Well, she's almost tempting him. Hey,
yeah.
You can... you can just chill out here and let other people do the hard stuff.
Right. It feels like a more magical version of like being put on a lie detector test to say, when tempted, what would you do?
Yeah. Or what would tempt you not to do this too?
Oh, interesting. That's a good way of describing it. She has this power to kind of synthesize what they seek most aside from the quest.
Right.
Yeah. So just really though, this section, it's just like, okay, you're in a place now where like you're not physically challenged, but now maybe you're mentally, there's a temptation, at least mentally, to just not even give up, but just stop and take it easy. And that's what's going on mm-hmm. here. And again, they're like bringing up, I mean, this is going to be a free choice is what it would seem, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I feel like sometimes with the temptation question, it's like, well, are they lazy or whatever, or scared and they just don't want to do it? It's a little more complex than that. It's saying turn aside from this quest to others, meaning like to other quests almost. Like,
no, I think the others meant like let other people do it.
Okay. Oh yeah, I misread that. You're right. But something about these ideas that she puts in his head, and what we'll see later in the chapter, everyone might have other struggles that they're trying to, like, other battles they're trying to fight. And they might be good things, too, but they just aren't this quest. And that might be their temptation, is to like, fight what they feel is a different sort of good fight.
Right.
Okay, let's see. Galadriel had that quote. Together, so she and Celeborn, together through ages of the world, we have fought the long defeat. I want to recall Haldir's speech from the last chapter on this. So do you need like a refresher on that?
On Haldir's speech? I remember the content of it. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, so Haldir was talking about going across the sea, you know, because at best the elves are going to draw in this conflict. Like, they might defeat Sauron, but then the power of the Three Rings is going to be over, and so then Lothlorien would probably diminish after that, and it'll be the time for the elves to all go across the sea. And he's actually even nervous to do that because he loves the Malorn trees that are basically are like the dominant thing in this forest, and he hasn't heard of them anywhere else in the world, even across in Valinor. So like, he's not even looking forward to the heaven on earth paradise that's just across the sea for elves. And then, yeah, like Galadriel herself, like this long defeat. You'll hear in our special that she, if there's, like, basically she's one of the few characters that has basically literally seen it all, you know, like, mm-hmm. and she had so many siblings and cousins that were in the Silmarillion and everything, and they all basically get killed. You know, the only question is how cool was their death? And you know, she sees like the elves in their time of glory, but then also she's seen evil deeds from elves, other elves, and then she's been fighting all these wars. And you know, this goes back to kind of like what Elrond was saying in the Council of Elrond, like all the fruitless victories. Like, she just sees these guys, like, they defeated Sauron. She's been at war. She has personally been at war with Sauron for probably like 5,000 years at this point. You know, like, I mean, so she's just going at it, but everything that she does, she still considers it, we're just slipping down gradually into this slow but long defeat, you know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that should kind of strike people. I don't know, what do you make of it first before I get into the notes I have for this?
Well, one, we've seen from the beginning that she's playing the long game, just like we were saying before. Celeborn is maybe concerned with some worldly issues, even in a magical place. She's definitely playing the long game. But it also, at a different level, feels like she's... I can't think of anything specifically, but like, so much great writing and poetry and the type of thing talks about mortality and time passing.
Yeah.
Like, the beauty and challenges of people trying to achieve things, but death being like the inevitable end.
Right.
We've established that men are mortals and the elves are immortal, but at the scale of the gods, basically, the elves are, maybe at the scale of Middle Earth, I should say, the elves are mortal in the sense that they have to eventually pass to Valinor. It's the same type of melancholy, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. In the same way that, like, all this great literature describes, like, the challenges of men trying to do things through the ages, but knowing that they're eventually going to die, feels like Galadriel's been fighting a fight her entire life against evil, but also knows that someday she's gonna like have to slide back and return to Valinor.
Okay, so I think you're right with the men. I think you're wrong with the elf.
Okay.
Almost straight up wrong, Clifford.
Okay.
So the men, you're right. So like this feeling, because Tolkien, that's a feeling that he has in real life. And we'll talk about Tolkien's in a second here. But men, yes, men think that life's like one long defeat because no matter what anybody does, it ends with death. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So from that point of view, maybe they would actually be jealous of the elves, which there's many stories in Middle Earth where they are. And if you look at Christianity, you know, death was a bad thing that came about in Genesis, right?
Mm.
So anyways, we established Music of the Ainur special, like men are the exiles of the world, you know, like they're restless and this isn't truly their home and they have to die and everything. And then we mentioned in the Council of Elrond that like, even if the good guys win, the elves' time is over. So back to the elves here too. And then throughout the Silmarillion, like the whole history of it, they defeat one bad force, but then another stronger one keeps arising over and over again. You know, it's never final. Like back to Elrond's fruitless victories line, right? You know, they even defeated Sauron, but he wasn't diminished. He wasn't gone forever. And now he's back, you know? So it's like, what? You know, we're just back at it, right? It's like World War II after World War I. I would say there's a bleak outlook for both men and elves, okay? And this is getting to the root of Tolkien's famous history's one long defeat quote in his letters. And then you look at Tolkien's own life too, where he would see, you know, history is just one long defeat. Okay, he was orphaned because both his parents passed away. Lots of his friends die in World War II. And then, you know, there's still lots of his friends die in World War I. Lots of relatives die as well. And this is what everybody kind of faces. So what's interesting though is, well, actually think too, especially about, he's only confining this to the word history, okay? So when men die, once that happens, they actually do get to see a final victory, okay? Because that's like, theoretically, that'll be eternal life, right?
Okay.
You know, like that's, they enter into the second music of Iluvatar in this world cosmology. And then in real life, as a Christian, he would probably believe that, you know, you go on to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the resurrection of the dead at the end of time too, or whatever, however that all fits together.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, though, the elves, like Galadriel, just keep living on. And they probably almost feel, I would almost think that Galadriel probably feels left behind at this point. You know, and then this long defeat's just interminable. Like, it's just going to go on and on, you know?
I see what you're getting at, but I still feel like whether you're zooming in or out, it's still a parallel description for Galadriel.
No, but like, when do the elves actually even get to see that? I brought up history. The elves are stuck in history, right? Men die, you're outside of time,
right, you know?
Like, you go somewhere else. You're not in any sort of history anymore. You're not even in this world anymore. Uh-huh. Elves are stuck in this world, and they're stuck in history. There's a quote here from Joseph Pierce's book, too, that I think would help this situation, shed light on the situation, too. He believed that human history, rooted in a fallen world, was doomed to become little more than a succession of defeats and disappointments, and that even victories carried the shadows of impending loss. Yet, history is temporary, locked in time as much as it is rooted in the fall, and is itself but a shadow of eternity. Beyond the defeats of history, there is always hope of eternal joy. Actually, I am a Christian, and indeed a Roman Catholic, he wrote in 1956, shortly after the publication of Lord of the Rings, so that I do not expect history to be anything but a long defeat, though it contains, and in a legend may contain more clearly and movingly, some samples or glimpses of final victory. Is that confusing, or does that help?
No, it makes sense. I don't feel like it. It all makes sense. It all fits. I'm just saying I still feel like he kind of drew inspiration for the whole cosmology of the elves from his feelings about the real world, about history being this long defeat.
That's the worst part, though, for the elves, is that they're stuck in the history. Men, you die, and then you're outside of history. The elves are still stuck here unless you get killed, and Galadriel's the only one that hasn't.
You're saying the crucial difference is there's no chance of redemption for the elves.
Not that we know of, because, you know, men are, like, in the Middle Earth, men are guaranteed to be in the second song of Iluvatar. We don't really know what happens to elves. And, yeah, it seems like this feeling, he feels this in the real world, like, yes, our life is going to be end in defeat when we just die, you know, because and death isn't a good thing, I guess. But, mm-hmm. you know, the elves would actually not say that, because then it's just like, well, you get to go to whatever is beyond this life, and we have to still stay here.
Mm-hmm.
And Tolkien, you know, he basically says, like, he looks at this world like that because he believes in the fall. So this is Genesis, like serpent in the mm-hmm. garden mm-hmm. eating the apple. And because of that, all of history for men's history, it'll always be imperfect, and you'll never be able to get a final victory outside of time. And that's what sucks for the elves, is that they are stuck in time.
Okay.
Like, even when they go to the paradise in Valinor, even, like, there's the one quote in the Silmarillion somewhere that even the Valar will be jealous of the gift of death, because they're still stuck in the world too, you know, and even they'll get tired of it and weary of it. Mm-hmm. As we've seen too, like, as we said, Galadriel's been through a lot too, and so this is basically like, I don't know, this is almost, she's almost completed like everything there is to do in Middle Earth by this point too.
Well, point being, she has a very unique perspective going up against Sauron. That's especially pertinent for the quest at hand. They remained some days in Lothlorien, so far as they could tell or remember. All the while that they dwelt there, the sun shone clear, save for a gentle rain that fell at times, and passed away, leaving all things fresh and clean. The air was cool and soft, as if it were early spring, yet they felt about them the deep and thoughtful quiet of winter. It seemed to them that they did little but eat and drink and rest, and walk among the trees, and it was enough. They had not seen the lord and lady again, and they had little speech with the elven folk, for few of those knew or would use the Westron tongue. Haldir had bidden them farewell and had gone back again to the fences of the north, where great watch was now kept since the tidings of Moria that the company had brought. Legolas was away much among the Galadrin, and after the first night he did not sleep with the other companions, though he returned to eat and talk with them. Often he took Gimli with him when he went abroad in the land, and the others wondered at this change.
Okay, so yeah, cool. That last part was interesting.
Like, there's some reconciliation going on, maybe.
Right, and I would have to assume that that was all sparked when Galadriel actually offered him a olive branch. Okay, and then, let's see, they're reminiscing about Gandalf as they become physically healed, and then they're also hearing elves sing lamentations about his fall all over the trees, even though they can barely see the elves. They said, Mithrandir, Mithrandir, sang the elves, O Grey Pilgrim, for so they loved to call him. But if Legolas was with the company, he would not interpret the songs for them, saying that he had not the skill, and that for him the grief was still too near. A matter for tears, and not yet for song. Sorry, Mithrandir is Gandalf, that's what they call him.
That's the elvish name for him.
Right. And then Frodo puts together a page-long song, lamentation for Gandalf, and Sam thought it was really good, but we're not going to spend the time to talk about it, because we got other stuff to cover here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so one evening, Frodo and Sam, they're strolling around, and Frodo had the dread that he knew that they'd have to set out again soon. The feeling's coming back that it's like, okay, we're in this really, really great place. Once again, we gotta leave. Just like how we had to leave Bombadil's house and we had to leave Rivendell. It's like, great. We're gonna have to set mm-hmm. out, take this hard road again soon.
Mm-hmm.
But before all that, we got this big scene here. So again, Frodo and Sam are walking around, and then you want to take that quote.
What do you think of the elves now, Sam? He asked. I asked you the same question once before. It seems a very long while ago, but you have seen more of them since then.
I have indeed, said Sam. And I reckon there's elves and elves. They're all elvish enough. But they're not all the same. Now, these folks aren't wanderers or homeless, and seem a bit nearer to the likes of us. They seem to belong here, more even than hobbits do in the Shire. Whether they've made the land or the land's made them, it's hard to say, if you take my meaning. It's wonderfully quiet here. Nothing seems to be going on, and nobody seems to want it to. If there's any magic about, it's right down deep, where I can't lay my hands on it, in a manner of speaking.
You can see and feel it everywhere, said Frodo.
Well, said Sam, you can't see nobody working it. No fireworks like poor Gandalf used to show. I wonder if we don't see nothing of the lord and lady in all these days. I fancy that she could do some wonderful things if she had the mind. I'd dearly love to see some elf magic, Mr. Frodo.
I love that line from Sam. The, whether they've made the land or the land's made them, it's hard to say.
Mm.
That's like, one, very fitting for Lord of the Rings, how the land is tied in with the story.
Yeah.
And you can't really tell which one made the other, but also just thinking about any place in the world where you've got like a kind of a culture and a place so deeply entwined that you can't separate them.
Yeah.
It's very cool.
Now, conveniently, Galadriel, she turns up right then and there for the first time since their original meeting.
Which only contributes to this sense that not only can she kind of see into everybody's minds and maybe read their thoughts, it's like she's listening to everything. She kind of like heard them thinking about her, and so she shows up. Which, I mean, we can discuss more once we dive into this, but I feel like it contributes to a sense of her, what's the proper term? Omnipresence?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Or
just her mystique.
Or omniscience. Sorry, omniscience is the word. We get the impression that she kind of sees all things.
Okay, yeah.
Maybe she's not omnipotent, but she's...
Yeah, she's pretty close to it. She was, like, playing mind tricks on him the first time. So.
Right. It reinforces that she's, like, a character from outside the story, almost.
Yeah.
Or from a different level of the story.
Yeah. First chunk here.
Turning aside, she led them toward the southern slopes of the hill of Carras Galadon, and passed through a high green hedge that came into an enclosed garden. No trees grew there, and it lay open to the sky. The evening star had risen and was shining with white fire above the western woods. Down a long flight of steps the lady went into the deep green hollow, through which ran murmuring the silver stream that issued from the fountain on the hill. At the bottom, upon a low pedestal carved like a branching tree, stood a basin of silver, wide and shallow, and beside it stood a silver ewer. With water from the stream, Galadriel filled the basin to the brim, and breathed on it, and when the water was still again, she spoke.
"Here is the mirror of Galadriel," she said. "I have brought you here so that you may look in it, if you will."
The air was very still, and the dell was dark, and the elf lady beside him was tall and pale. "What shall we look for, and what shall we see?" asked Frodo, filled with awe.
"Many things I can command the mirror to reveal," she answered, "and to some I can show what they desire to see. But the mirror will also show things unbidden, and those are far stranger and more profitable than things which we wish to behold. What you will see, if you leave the mirror free to work, I cannot tell, for it shows many things that were, and many things that are, and many things that may yet be. But which it is that he sees, even the wisest cannot tell. Do you wish to look?"
Frodo did not answer.
"And you," she said, turning to Sam, "for it is what your folk would call magic, I believe, though I do not understand clearly what they mean, and they seem to use the same word of the deceits of the enemy. But this, if you will, is the magic of Galadriel. Did you not say that you wished to see elf magic?"
"I did," said Sam, trembling a little beyond fear and curiosity. "I'll have a peep, lady, if you're willing."
Let's break there just to talk about some stuff. So the only magic that she did here was she filled up a basin and then she breathed on it. And then now all of a sudden you're going to look in there and you might have some sort of vision of whatever. And we don't know what's going to happen.
Some vision of the past, the present, and a little bit of the future.
Possible future.
Right. But you don't know which one it is.
Right. And then the more interesting part, too, is she's like, "Well, this is what hobbits would consider magic, but I don't really get what you're talking about." And then, especially since you would use the same word for when evil magic's occurring, too.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a good time to get into these two different kinds of magics here. So the first one, this cool one, this Lothlorien elves one, is the almost magic of enchantment, kind of. And then the second one is the evil magic. So let's see. So about the first one, Peter Kraft in his book, he was saying fairies. So this is like the whole Elfland. And if anything embraces fairy the most, it would be Lothlorien, I would have to say. "Fairy itself may perhaps most nearly be translated by magic. But it is magic of peculiar mood and power, at the furthest pole from the vulgar devices of the laborious scientific magician." So that was actually a quote straight from Tolkien. So yeah, so this enchanting magic of Lothlorien, it kind of seems to me, from what I was reading, like, this is somebody that, like, leans into their God-given, not really powers, but just abilities, and, you know, it ends up showing off his glory, like, God's glory in this. What I was thinking, too, when I was reading this is, compare Galadriel breathing on the water, and it changes into this mirror that can show visions. Like, it's almost like a fortune teller's ball. Compare that to the example I had was an ordained priest. They have the power to turn bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. So that would seem like a magical power, right? just like kind of like what Galadriel's doing, like she's using magic to do that.
Right.
Galadriel and a priest would never like consider this like a magical power, you know, like, I don't know, like the hokey kind of magic in like Harry Potter or something, right? It's just something that they have the ability to do. You know what I'm kind of saying? Like they just lean into it.
Right.
Versus the other one, the evil magic is going to be what Tolkien was saying is the laborious and scientific magician. You know, so this is like, think of man-made tools or like...
like alchemy, sort of.
Right, but that actually works.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, where you're playing God and you're using evil tools or man-made tools to conquer nature.
Mm.
And when you get down to that definition, then there's going to be countless examples of this, right, that we can all mm-hmm. recognize.
Mm-hmm. You're leveraging tools that give you tremendous power for ends that are not wisdom, I guess.
Yeah.
That gets a little bit subjective, though, when it's just when you're just trying to decide, like, is the end result godly or not?
Anyways, this evil one, there'll be other examples throughout the book. We'll see that. But basically, think of anything that the orcs do. They probably, without fail, will be using this evil magic. Like that Hobbit chapter that we talked about, using all the technological weapons and everything. The culture had, in quotes, advanced.
Well, maybe in general, weapons of war is like a good example.
Yeah.
Those are things that men have developed to be destructive and take lives, destroy things, and bring chaos.
So Tolkien talks about this evil magic in one of his letters here, to quote from Peter Ch's book. It is a magic of external plans or devices instead of the development of inherent inner powers or talents, bulldozing the real world or coercing other wills. The machine is our more obvious modern form. I have not used magic consistently, and indeed the elven queen Galadriel is obliged to remonstrate with the hobbits on their confused use of the word both for the devices and operations of the enemy and for those of the elves. The elves are, in my tales, to demonstrate the difference. Their magic is art, and its object is art, not power. Subcreation, not domination, tyrannous reforming of creation. And Peter Krafe goes on to say, fairy magic is the opposite of reductionism. It is the creativity, and it makes the world richer, and it glorifies the world for beauty. It amplifies nature into art. The other magic destroys nature, reduces the world to a machine for the sake of power. And the central symbol of the Lord of the Rings, the ring, is precisely this second magic.
That's maybe the best division or explanation we've gotten, because if we flash back to the music of the Ainur, the cosmology of Lord of the Rings, and the notion of subcreation, the tree of creation from Iluvatar out to the other demigods onto Middle-earth. But elves and men are both the children of Iluvatar. And so anything that the elves or men create are subcreations. And anything that they make that falls kind of on the next level of creation below that is wholesome in the sense that it's part of Iluvatar's grand plan, this like branching tree of creation. But to try to supersede, to like try to jump up a level, kind of in the way that Melkor always wanted to be not a performer in the symphony, but the conductor, or in his own symphony, to try to jump beyond the level at which you are, that's the issue.
All right, let's get into what they actually see here. So Sam first.
There's only stars, as I thought, he said.
Then he gave a low gasp, for the stars went out. As if a dark veil had been withdrawn, the mirror grew gray and then clear. There was sun shining, and the branches of trees were waving and tossing in the wind. But before Sam could make up his mind what it was that he saw, the light faded, and now he thought he saw Frodo, with a pale face, lying fast asleep under a great dark cliff. Then he seemed to see himself going along a dim passage and climbing an endless winding stair. It came to him suddenly that he was looking urgently for something, but what it was he did not know. Like a dream, the vision shifted and went back, and he saw the trees again, but this time they were not so close, and he could see what was going on. They were not waving in the wind, they were falling and crashing to the ground.
"Hi," cried Sam in an outraged voice. "There's that Ted Sandy man a-cutting down trees as he shouldn't. They didn't ought to be felled. It's that avenue beyond the mill that shades the road to Bywater. I wish I could get at Ted. I'd fell him."
But now Sam noticed that the old mill had vanished, and a large red brick house building was being put up where it had stood. Lots of folks were busily at work. There was a tall red chimney nearby. Black smoke seemed to cloud the surface of the mirror.
"There's some devilry at work in the Shire," he said. Elrond knew what he was about when he wanted to send Mr. Merry back.
Then suddenly Sam gave a cry and sprang away.
"I can't stay here," he said wildly. "I must go home. They've dug up Bagshot Row. And there's the poor old gaffer going down the hill with his bits of things in a barrow. I must go home."
"You cannot go home alone," said the lady. "You do not wish to go home without your master before you looked in the mirror.
You knew that evil things might well be happening in the Shire. Remember that the mirror shows many things, and not all have yet come to pass. Some never come to be, unless those that behold the visions turn aside from their path to prevent them. The mirror is dangerous as a guide of deeds."
Sam sat on the ground and put his head in his hands. "I wish I had never come here, and I don't want to see no more magic," he said, and fell silent. After a moment, he spoke again, thickly, as if struggling with tears. "No, I'll go home by the long road with Mr. Frodo, or not at all," he said. "But I hope I do get back some day. If what I've seen turns out to be true, somebody's going to catch it hot."
All right, thoughts?
Well, spooky for the Shire.
Yeah.
Seems like bad things are afoot, but maybe we did know that, because we got the illusion from Elrond quite a while back.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't really know anything, I'd say, but yeah, I mean...
There was the implication.
There's a possibility,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
What about this mirror itself?
Pretty fascinating. The concept that you don't know if it's past, present, or future is a really good one for the story.
Okay, so he's got an influence for that.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you want to take a guess? Did I not leave that part? I think I left that part.
Macbeth?
Dude, you get that on your own?
No.
All right, do you remember that book?
Very vaguely.
Okay, who wrote it?
Shakespeare. Okay, I remember that.
I was more so asking you just so that the audience can know, but yeah. Okay. All right, so anyways, yeah. So we've been talking about Shakespeare a little bit, so we're going to get into it here. This is like the first controversial relationship with Shakespeare, but you're going to see throughout Lord of the Rings that Macbeth, at the very least of all the books, this one influenced him.
We heard a little while ago the quote that Tolkien had a...
cordially disliked Shakespeare.
Yeah, cordially disliked. So sort of a grudging respect.
Well, no, it was more so like, in reality, he probably liked Shakespeare, but he thought he was overrated.
Gotcha.
Like a hipster.
So, but they were from the same part of England, right?
Right, so he'd felt a connection to him for that reason. Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into like why he would think he's overrated like right now. So, but just a refresher, Macbeth, this is the one where they're in Scotland and like he gets a prophecy from a bunch of witches that he'll be king. And then when he gets that prophecy, Macbeth then sets out like, okay, I got to make sure this comes true. And that involves killing all of his rivals, including the current king and anybody else that's a claimant to that throne. You know, and this is one of the tragic plays, I guess, because this does not have a happy ending. So, thing to wonder about that should be stirring in you as you're reading this book is, well, if he didn't act on this prophecy and do these immoral things, maybe this prophecy still would have come true some other way, and he would become king, and he wouldn't get killed at the end of this play, which is what happens.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tom Shippey's bringing up that he says, what Macbeth doesn't understand is, you must do your duty regardless of what you think is going to happen. Now, think about Galadriel's line about the visions here in the mirror, where she says, some never come to be unless those that behold the vision turn aside from their path to prevent them.
Yeah, which is, her language is always a little hard to understand at first. But she's very specifically saying, one way of reading this at least, is that the things in the future will not happen unless you deliberately try to prevent them from happening, right?
Right.
Am I getting that right? Which is a tremendously weird, future prophecy thing.
And even that, though, is probably not guaranteed either.
Right. But it's as though it's as if saying this is a false prophecy unless you act on it, in which case the opposite of your actions will come to pass. It's kind of like the...
Well, okay. And so, Shakespeare, he gives the example of, here's somebody that heard a prophecy, tried to make it come true, and then it all turned out really bad for him. Tolkien's trying to put a positive spin on it here. Well, let me have Tom Shippey take it. Tolkien was trying then to make Shakespeare more positive, a bold venture. A bold venture, but based on a clear insight itself, based on a very minute reading. If he disliked Shakespeare, other than in joke. It was because he thought Shakespeare, a true poet with a deep taproot into Old English stories and traditions, had to often neglect that root for later and sillier interests. You with me so far on that? Does that make sense?
That last part is a little...
Well, so he's saying, like, Shakespeare's drawing on the same, like, these sources of wisdom in basically Anglo-Saxon history. Tolkien mm-hmm. draws on these for Lord of the Rings. And he knew right. that Shakespeare also had these in, like, the back of his mind. He was drawing on them, too. But uh-huh. then he thinks he focuses on something silly and stupid. Or just, like, what's the word? Frivolous, maybe. Or just, okay. like, less important, you know?
Okay.
So he goes on to say here, too... King Lear stems from the gaudy fictions of Geoffrey of Monmouth, and yet it contains one of the ancient and resonant lines in the mad scene of Poor Tom. And the line is, "Child Roland to the dark tower came." The line obviously comes from some lost ballad telling the story of how Child Roland went to Elfland to rescue his sister from the wicked king, a monster legend. Now, why Shakespeare couldn't have told that tale, Tolkien must have reflected, instead of bothering with King Lear. As things were, Tolkien had to tell the Dark Tower story himself. Still, there was no doubt that Shakespeare knew something. Basically, what Tolkien's saying is, like, in Macbeth here with, like, this prophecy thing, and then also, more so, the example he gave is, like, he tells this whole King Lear story, which is based off some other ancient Anglo-Saxon tradition. But that Anglo-Saxon tradition had that line that I just read about the Dark Tower, and Tolkien's like, oh, you know, you're going to tap into these traditions and make up stories for it. Tell the Dark Tower story, which sounds way cooler and more interesting than the whatever King Lear's about. Like, who cares? You know? And right, so then right. and so then Tolkien's like, well, you know, there is this Dark Tower line, so now I got to tell that story, which is obviously in Lord of the Rings, Barad-dûr is the Dark Tower where they're going to end up coming close to in the middle of Mordor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, that strays off a little bit from that interesting idea about, like, the prophecy and going out of your way to make it come true or not come true.
Yeah, but that's certainly good precedent for it.
"Do you now wish to look, Frodo?" said the Lady Galadriel. "You did not wish to see elf magic and were content." "Do you advise me to look?" asked Frodo. "No," she said, "I do not counsel you one way or the other. I am not a counselor. You may learn something, and whether what you see to be fair or evil, that may be profitable. And yet, it may not. Seeing is both good and perilous. Yet, I think, Frodo, that you have the courage and wisdom enough for the venture, or I would not have brought you here. Do as you will." "I will look," said Frodo.
And he climbed on the pedestal and bent over the dark water. At once the mirror cleared, and he saw a twilight land. Mountains loomed dark in the distance against a pale sky. A long gray road wound back out of sight. Far away, a figure came slowly down the road, faint and small at first, but growing larger and clearer as it approached. Suddenly, Frodo realized that it reminded him of Gandalf. He almost called aloud the wizard's name, and then he saw that the figure was clothed not in gray but in a white that shone faintly in the dusk, and in its hand there was a white staff. The head was so bowed that he could see no face, and presently the figure turned aside round a bend in the road and went out of the mirror's view. Doubt came into Frodo's mind. Was this a vision of Gandalf on one of his many lonely journeys long ago, or was it Saruman? The vision now changed. Brief and small, but very vivid, he caught a glimpse of Bilbo walking restlessly about his room. The table was littered with disordered papers. Rain was beating on the windows. Then there was a pause. And after it, many swift scenes followed that Frodo in some way knew to be parts of a great history in which he had become involved. The mist cleared, and he saw a sight which he had never seen before but knew at once. The sea. Darkness fell. The sea rose and raged in a great storm. Then he saw, against the sun, sinking blood-red into a rack of clouds, the black outline of a tall ship with torn sails, riding up out of the west. Then a wide river flowing through a populous city. Then a white fortress with seven towers, and then again a ship with black sails. But now it was morning again, and the water rippled with light, and a banner bearing the emblem of a white tree shone in the sun. A smoke as of fire and battle arose, and again the sun went down in a burning red that faded into a gray mist, and into the mist a small ship passed away, twinkling with lights. It vanished, and Frodo sighed and prepared to draw away. But suddenly the mirror went altogether dark, as dark as if a hole had opened in the world of sight, and Frodo looked into emptiness. In the black abyss, there appeared a single eye that slowly grew until it filled nearly all the mirror. So terrible was it that Frodo stood rooted, unable to cry out or to withdraw his gaze. The eye was rimmed with fire, but was itself glazed, yellow as a cat's, watchful and intent, and the black slit of its pupil opened down a pit, a window into nothing. Then the eye began to move, searching this way and that, and Frodo knew with certainty and horror that among the many things that it sought, he himself was one. But he also knew that it could not see him, not yet, not unless he willed it. The ring that hung upon its chain about his neck grew heavy, heavier than stone, and his head was dragged downwards. The mirror seemed to be growing hot, and curls of steam were rising from the water. He was slipping forward.
"Do not touch the water," said the Lady Galadriel softly.
The vision faded, and Frodo found that he was looking at the cool stars twinkling in the silver basin. He stepped back, shaking all over, and looked at the lady.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, we haven't actually focused much on the content of... Or we didn't focus much on the content of what Sam actually saw. We were more just concerned that he was seeing a vision and stuff. And same with Frodo. If you read the books before, if you've seen the movies, you can kind of pick out what that stuff's all talking about and referencing, but I'm sure it'll come up later, so we don't really have to focus on it.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I will, well, stop me if we shouldn't talk about this, but assuming Frodo sticks the course and does not falter in his quest, doesn't turn astray, doesn't let this mirror guide his judgment and change his decisions, the things in the future shouldn't come true based on what Galadriel's saying.
No, I don't think we know that.
Doesn't she say those things won't come to pass unless...
I don't think that's guaranteed. That's what she said to Sam, and Sam takes the advice, and is, even though he sees everything, he's more resolute to follow Frodo, because she does give the warning that it's more likely to happen if you go out of your way to try to stop it.
I think I misread earlier. I was thinking that she was referring to all the future things never come to pass unless the beholder turns aside from their path. But she's saying just some.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's pretty hard to make out how to do that.
Yes.
I'm almost actually wondering, like, why should I look in this thing? Like, I don't know if I would actually do it.
Right.
But yeah, anyways, Frodo, though, from everything you were reading, he kind of feels, he somehow is starting to feel like, and be aware, finally, of his place and how he fits in all this stuff. Like, he's aware that this is a great history going on, and he's part of it. Like, this is like a culmination of something. And he really is actually the center of it, obviously, because he's got the ring. That's an interesting moment. The main hero of the story is aware that he's doing great things.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sees the eye, and he says, but it couldn't see him yet. Not unless he willed it, which is weird. Like, the he is Frodo here. Like, he could will the eye to see him if he wanted.
Yeah, that's super strange. We've gotten the impression in the past that when he puts on the ring, he becomes visible to the eye, right?
Yeah, well, the only reason he would will it is probably some desire stirred in it by the ring. Would probably be...
Understood. They're linked together. Okay. Yeah.
And it was even like kind of the ring that was almost pulling him into the water until Galadriel spoke to stop him, like, hey, don't touch the water.
Yeah,
kind of weird. "I know what it is you last saw," she said, "for that is also in my mind. Do not be afraid, but do not think that only by singing amid the trees, nor even by the slender arrows of elven bows, is the land of Lothlorien maintained and defended against its enemy. I say to you, Frodo, that even as I speak to you, I perceive the Dark Lord and know his mind, or all of his mind that concerns the elves, and he gropes ever to see me and my thought, but still the door is closed."
She lifted up her white arms and spread out her hands toward the east in a gesture of rejection and denial. Erendil, the evening star, most beloved of the elves, shone clear above. So bright was it that the figure of the elven lady cast a dim shadow on the ground. Its rays glanced upon a ring about her finger. It glittered like polished gold overlaid with silver light, and a white stone in it twinkled as if the even star had come down to rest upon her hand. Frodo gazed at the ring with awe, for suddenly it seemed to him that he understood.
Sorry, just to break in here. Erendil, we should all know what that star is by now. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. And she's got the ring. Okay. Anyways. "Yes," she said, divining his thought. "It is not permitted to speak of it, and Elrond could not do so. But it cannot be hidden from the ring bearer and one who has seen the eye. Verily, it is in the land of Lorien, upon the finger of Galadriel, that one of the three remains. This is Nenya, the ring of Edmund, and I am its keeper. He suspects, but he does not know, not yet. Do you not see now wherefore your coming is to us as the doorstep of doom? For if you fail, then we are laid bare to the enemy. Yet if you succeed, then our power is diminished, and Lothlorien will fade, and the tides of time will sweep it away. We must depart into the west, or dwindle to a rustic folk of dell and cave, slowly to forget and to be forgotten.
Frodo bent his head. And what you wish, he said at last.
That what should be, shall be, she answered. The love of elves for their land and their work is deeper than the deeps of the sea, and their regret is undying and cannot ever wholly be assuaged. Yet they will cast all away rather than submit to Sauron, for they know him now. For the fate of Lothlorien, you are not answerable, but only for the doing of your own task. Yet I could wish, were it of any avail, that the One Ring had never been wrought, or had remained forever lost.
You are wise and fearless and fair, Lady Galadriel, said Frodo. I will give you the One Ring if you ask for it. It is too great of a matter for me. Galadriel laughed with a sudden clear laugh.
Wise the Lady Galadriel may be, she said, yet here she has met her match in courtesy. Gently are you revenged for my testing of heart at our first meeting. You begin to see with a keen eye. I do not deny that my heart has greatly desired to ask what you offer. For many long years I had pondered what I might do should the great ring come into my hands. And behold, it was brought within my grasp. The evil that was devised long ago works on in many ways, whether Sauron himself stands or falls. Would not that have been a noble deed to set to the credit of his ring, if I had taken it by force or fear from my guest? And now at last it comes. You will give me the ring freely. In place of a dark lord, you would set up a queen, and I shall not be dark, but beautiful and terrible as the morning and the night, fair as the sea and the sun and the snow upon the mountain, dreadful as the storm and lightning, stronger than the foundations of the earth. All shall love me and despair.
She lifted up her hand, and from the ring that she wore there issued a great light that illuminated her and left all else dark. She stood before Frodo, seeming now tall beyond measurement, and beautiful beyond enduring, terrible and worshipful. Then she let her hand fall, and the light faded, and suddenly she laughed again, and lo, she was shrunken, a slender elf woman, clad in simple white, whose gentle voice was soft and sad.
I passed the test, she said. I will diminish and go into the west and remain Galadriel.
Whoa.
Big chunk. Super big chunk.
I mean, this goes back to some of the most fundamental discussions we've had about the ring. And yeah, the temptation of the ring, the power, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But she puts it so eloquently here.
Yeah.
As clearly she's a force for good in this world, but clearly the ring would be something... The language there is especially good, like the combination of beautiful and terrible.
The entrance to this conversation is slightly different than anything else that we've had, because here Frodo's just offering it up freely, like he's going to give it away. You know, right. Imagine Bilbo trying to do that. He can't. He probably couldn't. You know, he needed Gandalf to even get rid of it. But Frodo's offering it freely, and he really means it. And this is a temptation for her, because she knows, okay, you can't steal this thing, or you can't take it by force, because clearly that's evil. You know, you're just welcoming yourself to be new Sauron, right?
Yeah, but she's so frank about it, too. She's like, I won't deny that my heart has desired this for a long time.
Well, she desires to be the one that controls the ring, and now here it is, a free gift. You know, especially after she tested Frodo when he first got there, now Frodo unwittingly is reversing the tables to massively higher stakes. Because you know? Yes. Galadriel is somebody that, like, if she had this ring, it's like, holy crap. That is, yeah, probably the biggest game changer you could have in this huge war, you know?
Right.
And yeah, what you're just saying, she already has one of the rings.
Which would, having two of them would make her, like, the single most powerful character.
Well, I mean, at that point, I don't even know if she'd still really need her one ring. We get into this pretty heavily in the Galadriel special, but the Nenya ring, that is how she holds power in Lothlorien here. Like, that's what's making this the Edenic paradise that we were saying in the last chapter. With this ring, she could keep all that, and that would go on forever because she had the ring. And she could then go on to, you know, ideally do good works, primary being defeat Sauron, you know, and defeat evil. But she also realizes that even just accepting this as a gift, she would still, in the long run, it would take longer than if she had taken it by force, but she would still become new Sauron. Mm-hmm. And that's what she's talking about when she says she passed the test. She resists that, right? So she passed.
Yes.
One of the books, they said, she says she has to diminish after this. So, like, even, like, being tested like this, you know, taxes you and diminishes you. Personally, I would say, and hopefully you get the sense of this after you listen to the Galadriel special, at this point, she's completed everything in Middle-earth right after this. Like, as soon as she passes this test, everything she wanted to do in the whole wide world is complete, and now it's really time for retirement.
That casts a whole nother, puts even more weight on this exchange, I guess. But exactly. That does make sense.
Now, before we finish off this section, there was one thing that I thought was cool that Fleming Rutledge was talking about, but I don't quite understand it. So I'm going to read it, and I'm going to see if you can just help me figure it out.
Okay. While you're looking for that, I'll note that we are, at least from Haldir, and then at the beginning of this chapter, we made this big deal about elves have this choice, or not choice, but the only two options in front of them are whether they're going to diminish or fight, kind of see their world end or flee from it. And right here, she just is providing her answer, at least, just like very directly. I guess we, in some way, we knew that it was inevitable, but it just seems like she's this kind of smiling old lady saying, yeah, that's how it will end. My time here is done. It's right. It's a peculiar ending, or it feels anticlimactic almost.
I don't know about that. I think it's, I mean, it's like sudden that she like, oh.
Yeah, I guess not anticlimactic, but suddenly post-climactic.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah, that I agree with. Yeah. Because, like, all right, you, like, she gives, like, the slightest glimpse of what she would look like if she's super evil. Or, right. I mean, if she, like, not evil, super powerful, which eventually becomes evil. But then it's like, nope, I reject that. I stand firmly against that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so anyways, here, listen to this quote. The irony in this scene is extreme, because if Frodo had actually given her the ring, it would have been the exact opposite of freely. It would have meant that he had fallen under the sway of the Dark Lord and no longer had any freedom. He would have become enslaved, just like Gollum, and so would she have become ensnared, just like Saruman. Instead, Galadriel sacrifices power and dominion and is released. The passive voice is intentional here, from its demonic grip. So I don't quite get how it wouldn't be free of Frodo to just hand over the ring. I'm confused by that.
She's saying that if Frodo were to hand over the ring, it would be because the ring has already corrupted him, and that the ring wants to hopscotch to a more powerful individual.
Okay.
I think.
And if if Galadriel accepted the ring, that wouldn't be freely. That would be the ring influencing
her. Yeah, she just would have been caught in the ring's trap. Okay. Sort of.
Okay. Okay, so then once I understand that, then the next part of this makes sense. So let me just read this. There's another correspondence here. Perhaps not too far-fetched. There is another temptation in a garden in the Bible. As Christ often fought onslaught of Satan in the Garden of Gethsemane on the night he was betrayed, so the Christian disciple must repeatedly struggle with the power of evil. There is a vital difference, however. The implication and token story of the mirror is unlike that of Christ. Neither Frodo nor Galadriel could have renounced the ring alone. They did it together. Thus, the theme of mutual service between members of the chosen fellowship is reinforced, with the little hobbit and the great lady serving one another as Jesus told his disciples that they would do. Kind of cool.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept that neither one can reject it on their own.
Okay, let's finish it up. Take us home.
They stood for a long while in silence. At length, the lady spoke again. Let us return, she said. In the morning, you must depart. For now, we have chosen, and the tides of fate are flowing. And then Frodo goes on to ask Galadriel about how he can see and know the thoughts of others, or why he hasn't seen others with the other rings and known their thoughts when he wears the ring. And she explains that basically he hasn't tried yet. And even now, just from having put on the ring a few times, he's become sharper. His vision's become sharper. And in fact, this whole scene, Sam didn't even know what was going on. Frodo was the only one who actually witnessed it in its entirety.
Well, Sam can see the ring on Galadriel's finger. Like, he literally couldn't see it. Whereas right. Frodo could, because he's the ring bearer of the One Ring.
Right. But also, Sam presumably couldn't see her kind of light up and grow tall and terrible. He just heard her talking.
Okay, yeah.
Is the suggestion. Yeah. But then it closes out with Sam saying, You know, to tell you the truth, I wasn't sure what you're talking about, but if you beg my pardon speaking out, I think Frodo is right. You should take his ring. You'd put things to rights. You'd stop them digging up the gaffer and turning him adrift. You'd make some folk pay for their dirty work. And she responds, I would, she said. That is how it would begin. But it would not stop with that. Alas, we will not speak more of it. Let us go. But I thought that, yeah, that second to last line is like the perfect summary of what we've been trying to say. Like the, that is how it would begin, like doing good things. Right. But it would not stop with that.
Right. Yeah. So Galadriel understands this. Elrond understands this. Mm-hmm. Gandalf understood this.
It seems like kind of the sign of like ultimate maturity in the story to recognize that. Where how the evil can rise out of good.
Yeah, and this is exactly what not a single evil character gets.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Saruman's totally willing to take this chance.
Right, it's like kind of like the ultimate like naivete of evil versus the maturity of good.
But yeah, so original intentions, not good enough. I'm sure we'll see that more again throughout the book. But I think we can leave it here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Clifford, let's see. I got some stuff that I want to update. Even though this was a long episode, I do want to talk about some... Oh, look at that. I wrote a note about re-listen to this section, and I didn't re-listen to this section. So... So, well, you know, okay.
Very helpful.
So I can't, History's One Long Defeat, I think I had more stuff to say on that, but whatever. That was kind of long, so. So, yeah, okay, so overall, I thought this was one of my weaker episodes, and that's mostly because this was a big episode. Like, this was the, this is the Mirror Galadriel episode.
Okay.
So we had four or five massive kind of important conversations. Like, it's not like the fun little crap like, oh, what influences Tolkien, but it's like, you know, like heart and meaning of the book kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we talked about Macbeth. So mm-hmm. I actually went back and I read Macbeth today, because, or not this week, because I kind of want to develop my own take on Shakespeare, you know, because we'll refer to him again later throughout the series or whatever. So I remember reading in high school. Didn't really care whatsoever. I mean, I wasn't opposed to it in high school. I don't know. What do you think? Because you had to read it too.
Similar. Mm-hmm. I was never like upset or like.
Right. I thought it was better.
Disliked it. Yeah.
I thought it was better than Romeo and Juliet as well.
Yeah, I remember it seeming a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So this time I enjoyed it.
To be clear, did you just read the entire Macbeth?
Yeah.
How long did it take you? I don't actually remember how long it is.
I did like an act a day, but I mean, it's gonna be like a 3-hour play. You know, 2 or 3 okay. hour play, so it can't be that long, you know. But it's like 5 fair. Acts, I did an act a day, you know, with coffee. Dude, coffee necessary for reading Shakespeare. But when you do it, then, like, but it was awesome. Like, coffee, great as an enhancer. Because, like, then I was, like, I was understanding the lines better, and the lines are great. I love reading Shakespeare, how when somebody gets murdered, how they all freak out in perfect meter and perfect poetry. It's awesome.
Yes.
So that was really fun. I highly appreciate that more now than when I didn't care in high school at all, right? You know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then lots of the scenes were really good. I thought the whole story as a whole was very classic and kind of elemental. Yeah, it's just a fundamental story, right? But I did think it was kind of surface level, and overall, the change in Macbeth was not gradual enough, because he starts out as, like, a good guy, then he starts murdering all these people to get to the top, and by the end, he's crazy, but I thought, like, the shifts were just too quick, okay. And especially for Lady Macbeth, too. That said, you know, Shakespeare, he was churning out hits, so I don't really fault him. You know, it's just, like, he's probably whipped this out in, like, a month, you know, at most, right? Anyways, but relevant to here, though, to our mirror conversation that we had in this chapter, Macbeth was dumb. Like, he tried to force the beneficial parts of the prophecy that he had heard for him to, like, come true, and then he tried to stop the unfavorable parts from coming true, which is like, no, you can't have it both ways. You either have to just let things come and hopefully the good parts come true, and maybe or maybe not the bad parts if they're actually bad for you.
Right. Yeah, it was kind of, that's almost like ignorance of the prophecy and just saying, hey, that's a good idea, and then trying to do something.
Yeah. Yeah, now the hobbits...
Prophecy aside.
Right, and then the hobbits, unlike Macbeth, have the sense of not setting out to make these prophecies come true. Like, they just see them, and whether they're going to come true or not, they're just going to go out and do their duty like they're supposed to, which is the exact opposite of what Macbeth does. Again, maybe if Macbeth had just went on autopilot and just like let the prophecies come true, maybe they would have come true. But instead, he does it in a very dishonorable way by murdering everybody else in his way to become king. So, yeah, that's my thoughts on that. How was your week?
Pretty good. Much to my chagrin, I thought that with this whole coronavirus thing, I'd be working less, and instead I'm working more.
Mm.
And kind of sucks sometimes. But other than that, I'm doing well. Nice. Staying healthy. Nice. How are you?
Pretty good. I did a century this weekend.
Oh, sweet.
Sorry, I did it in 6 hours.
Whoa.
And it was pretty cool. Mountainous, too. So I was pretty proud of that one.
That was awesome.
It was like six and a half total times, 6 hours like ride time.
Is this sticking with your plan to do a century every month?
Yeah, I got to catch up because I missed them in quarantine. But okay, now Our quarantine's over, so yeah.
Well, but, that's awesome.
That's the way to ride it. Unlike, you know, when we did our bike trip, we did the exact opposite, and it sucks. Uh-huh. It's really hard. This is like, that's the way to do it, because the more you drag it out, the harder it is. So you might as well just go at something that you think you can hold, and then just hopefully you do.
For anyone unaware, Patrick's theory of cycling exhaustion is that the faster you go, the less tired you are.
Yeah, you're going to be just as tired if you do 10 hours, which you could do in 6. You're going to be more fatigued. Yes, yes. You're better off if you can do 6 hours, do 6 hours.
Yeah, I'm mostly teasing you. I it's pretty logical. I feel like it's like that with the marathon, too, to an extent.
Probably, yeah. It's harder with running. It's definitely more so true with cycling, yeah. Especially where you can like draft, like if you could just sit behind people, holy crap, yeah. It's way easier. Yeah. Anything else, Clifford?
Nope, that's it for me.
All right, cool. This was a long episode. We will have the Galadriel special coming out too, so look out for that. It should be fun. Everybody have a good week though. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm. Thanks y'all.